Simon & Schuster Audio presents Angels and Demons by Dan Brown. Read by Richard Poe.
Physicist Leonardo Vetra smelled burning flesh, and he knew it was his own. He stared up in terror at the dark figure looming over him.
What do you want?
La chiave,
the raspy voice replied.
The password.
But I don't...
The intruder pressed down again, grinding the white-hot object deeper into Vetra's chest. There was the hiss of broiling flesh. Vetra cried out in agony.
There is no password!
He felt himself drifting toward unconsciousness. The figure glared.
Ne avevo paura. I was afraid of that.
Vetra fought to keep his senses, but the darkness was closing in. His only solace was in knowing his attacker would never obtain what he had come for. A moment later, however, the figure produced a blade and brought it to Vetra's face. The blade hovered, carefully, surgically.
For the love of God!
Vetra screamed. But it was too late. On another continent, Robert Langdon awoke with a start from a deep sleep. The phone beside his bed was ringing. Dazed, he picked up the receiver.
Hello?
I'm looking for Robert Langdon,
a man's voice said. Langdon sat up in his empty bed and tried to clear his mind.
This is Robert Langdon. Who is this?
My name is Maximilian Kohler. I'm a discrete particle physicist.
A what?
Langdon could barely focus.
Are you sure you've got the right Langdon?
You're a professor of religious iconology at Harvard University. You've written 3 books on symbology, and...
Do you know what time it is?
Langdon groaned.
I apologize. I have something you need to see. I can't discuss it on the phone, but I'll pay you well. If you leave immediately, you can be here by...
I'm not going anywhere. It's 5 o'clock in the morning.
Langdon hung up and collapsed back in bed. He closed his eyes and tried to fall back asleep. It was no use. Reluctantly, he put on his robe and went downstairs. Robert Langdon wandered barefoot through his deserted Massachusetts Victorian home and nursed his ritual insomnia remedy, a mug of steaming Nestle's Quick. The April moon filtered through the bay windows and played on the oriental carpets and various religious artifacts. Although not overly handsome in a classical sense, the 40-year-old Langdon had what his female colleagues referred to as an erudite appeal. Wisps of gray in his thick brown hair, probing blue eyes, an arrestingly deep voice, and the strong, carefree smile of a collegiate athlete. A varsity diver in prep school and college, Langdon still had the body of a swimmer. A toned, 6-foot physique that he vigilantly maintained with 50 laps a day in the university pool. As Langdon sat alone, absently gazing into the darkness, the silence of his bachelor home was shattered again, this time by the ring of his fax machine. Wearily, he returned his empty mug to the kitchen and walked slowly to his oak-paneled study. The incoming fax lay in the tray. Sighing, he scooped up the paper and looked at it. Instantly, a wave of nausea hit him. The image on the page was that of a human corpse. The body had been stripped naked, and its head had been twisted, facing completely backward. On the victim's chest was a terrible burn. The man had been branded, imprinted with a single word. It was a word Langdon knew well, very well.
Illuminati.
He stammered, his heart pounding.
It can't be.
In slow motion, afraid of what he was about to witness, Langdon rotated the fax 180 degrees. He looked at the word upside down. Instantly, the breath went out of him. It was like he had been hit by a truck. Barely able to believe his eyes, he rotated the fax again, reading the brand right side up and then upside down.
"Illuminati," he whispered.
Stunned, Langdon collapsed in a chair. Gradually, his eyes were drawn to the blinking red light on his fax machine. Whoever had sent this fax was still on the line. Trembling, he picked up the receiver.
"Do I have your attention now?"
the man's voice said.
"Yes, sir. You damn well do.
You want to explain yourself?"
"I tried to tell you before."
The voice was rigid, mechanical.
"I'm a physicist. I run a research facility. We've had a murder. My lab is only an hour's flight. I've taken the liberty of sending a plane for you. It will be in Boston in 20 minutes.
Langdon looked again at the facts, an ancient myth confirmed in black and white.
"You win," he said. "Tell me where to meet the plane."
Far away from Langdon's comfortable house, two men were meeting. The chamber was dark, medieval, stone.
"Benvenuto,"
the man in charge said. He was seated in the shadows, out of sight.
"Were you successful?"
"Si,"
the dark figure replied.
"Perfettamente."
His words were as hard as the rock walls.
"And do you have what I asked for?"
The killer's eyes glistened, black like oil. He produced a heavy electronic device and set it on the table. The man in the shadows seemed pleased.
"You have done well."
"Serving the Brotherhood is an honor,"
the killer said.
"Phase two begins shortly. Get some rest. Tonight we change the world."
Robert Langdon's Saab 900S tore out of the Callahan Tunnel and emerged on the east side of Boston Harbor near the entrance to Logan Airport. Checking his directions, Langdon found Aviation Road and turned left past the old Eastern Airlines building. 300 yards down the access road, a hangar loomed in the darkness. A large number 4 was painted on it. He pulled into the parking lot and got out of his car. A round-faced man in a blue flight suit emerged from behind the building.
"Robert Langdon?"
he called. The man's voice was friendly. He had an accent Langdon couldn't place.
"That's me,"
Langdon said, locking his car.
"Perfect timing," the man said. "I just landed. Follow me, please."
As they circled the building, Langdon felt tense. Not knowing what to expect, he had donned his usual classroom attire, a pair of chinos, a turtleneck, and a Harris tweed suit jacket. As they walked, he thought about the facts in his jacket pocket, still unable to believe the image it depicted. The pilot led Langdon the length of the hangar. They rounded the corner onto the runway. Langdon stopped dead in his tracks and gaped at the aircraft parked on the tarmac.
"We're riding in that?"
The craft before them was enormous. It was vaguely reminiscent of the space shuttle, except that the top had been shaved off, leaving it perfectly flat. Parked there on the runway, it resembled a colossal wedge.
"Runs on slush hydrogen,"
the pilot offered, like a father bragging about his newborn.
"The shell's a titanium matrix with silicon carbide fibers. She packs a 20-to-1 thrust weight ratio. Most jets run at 7-to-1. The director must be in one hell of a hurry to see you. He doesn't usually send the big boy."
Minutes later, Langdon was seated inside the empty cabin. The pilot buckled him into the front row and disappeared toward the front of the aircraft. The cabin itself looked surprisingly like a wide-body commercial airliner. The only exception was that it had no windows, which made Langdon uneasy. The engines roared to life beneath him, sending a deep shudder through the hull. Langdon swallowed hard and waited. He felt the plane start taxiing. A phone on the wall beside him beeped twice. Langdon lifted the receiver.
Hello? Comfortable, Mr. Langdon? Not at all. Just relax. We'll be there in an hour. And where exactly is there? Langdon asked, realizing he had no idea where he was headed.
Geneva,
the pilot replied, revving the engines.
The lab's in Geneva.
Geneva,
Langdon repeated, feeling a little better.
Upstate New York. I've actually got family near Seneca Lake. I wasn't aware Geneva had a physics lab.
The pilot laughed.
Not Geneva, New York, Mr. Langdon. Geneva, Switzerland. This plane goes Mach 15.
On a busy European street, the killer serpentined through the crowd. He was a powerful man, dark and potent. His muscles still felt hard from the thrill of his meeting.
It went well, he told himself.
Although his employer had never revealed his face, the killer felt honored to be in his presence.
Had it really been only 15 days since his employer had first made contact?
The killer still remembered every word of that call.
My name is Janus,
the caller had said. We are kinsmen of a sort.
We share an enemy. I hear your skills are for hire.
It depends on who you represent,
the killer replied. The caller told him, but the killer was skeptical.
The Brotherhood endures? I don't believe it.
Very soon you will believe. An irrefutable demonstration of the Brotherhood's power has already transpired.
What have you done?
The caller told him. The killer's eyes went wide.
An impossible task.
The next day, newspapers around the globe carried the same headline. The killer became a believer. Now, 15 days later, the killer's faith had solidified beyond the shadow of a doubt. One of the most covert and feared fraternities ever to walk the earth had called on him for service. So far, he had served them nobly. He had made his kill and delivered the item to Janus as requested. Now it was up to Janus to use his power to ensure the item's placement. As the killer walked, he imagined his ancestors smiling down on him. Today he was fighting their battle. He was fighting the same enemy they had fought for ages, as far back as the 11th century, when the enemy's crusading armies had first pillaged his land. His ancestors had formed a small but deadly army to defend themselves. They were renowned not only for their brutal killings, but also for celebrating their slayings by plunging themselves into drug-induced stupors. Their drug of choice was a potent intoxicant they called hashish. As their notoriety spread, these lethal men became known by a single word, hashashin, literally the followers of hashish. The name hashashin became synonymous with death in almost every language on earth. The word was still used today, even in modern English. But like the craft of killing, the word had evolved. It was now pronounced assassin. 64 minutes had passed when an incredulous and slightly airsick Robert Langdon stepped down the gangplank onto the sun-drenched runway.
I'm dreaming, he told himself. Any minute now I'll be waking up.
The pilot escorted Langdon to a black Peugeot sedan in a parking area beside the control tower. Moments later, they were speeding down a paved road that stretched out across the valley floor. A faint cluster of buildings rose in the distance. 2 minutes later, they entered a sweeping rotary that seemed to lead to the facility's main entrance. Looming before them was a rectangular, ultra-modern structure of glass and steel. An engraved granite slab in front of the building bore the legend CERN.
Conseil Européen pour la Recherche Nucléaire.
This is your stop, the pilot said. The director will meet you at this entrance.
Langdon noted a man in a wheelchair exiting the building. He looked to be in his early 60s, gaunt and totally bald, with a sternly set jaw. He wore a white lab coat and dress shoes, propped firmly on the wheelchair's footrest. Even at a distance, his eyes looked lifeless, like two gray stones. Uncertain what to expect, Langdon stepped from the vehicle. The man in the wheelchair accelerated toward Langdon and offered a clammy hand.
Mr. Langdon? We spoke on the phone. My name is Maximilian Kohler.
Maximilian Kohler, Director General of CERN, was known behind his back as König, King. It was a title more of fear than reverence for the figure who ruled over his dominion from a wheelchair throne. Langdon found himself practically jogging to keep up with Kohler's electric wheelchair as it sped silently toward the main entrance. The wheelchair was like none Langdon had ever seen, equipped with a bank of electronics, including a multi-line phone, a paging system, computer screen, even a small detachable video camera. King Kohler's Mobile Command Center. Langdon followed through a mechanical door into CERN's voluminous main lobby.
This way, please, Mr. Langdon.
Kohler's voice sounded almost computerized. His accent was rigid and precise, like his stern features. His wheelchair seemed to leap across the tiled floor.
I'm embarrassed to admit, Langdon ventured, trying to make conversation, that I've never heard of CERN. Not surprising, Kohler replied, his clipped response sounding harshly efficient. Most Americans do not see Europe as the world leader in scientific research.
A few minutes later, when Kohler and Langdon emerged from the rear of CERN's main complex into the stark Swiss sunlight, Langdon felt as if he'd been transported home. The scene before him looked like an Ivy League campus. A grassy slope cascaded downward onto an expansive lowlands, where clusters of sugar maples dotted quadrangles bordered by brick dormitories and footpaths. Scholarly-looking individuals with stacks of books hustled in and out of buildings.
These are our residential dorms, Kohler explained as he accelerated his wheelchair down the path toward the buildings. CERN single-handedly employs more than half the world's particle physicists, the brightest minds on Earth. Germans, Japanese, Italians, Dutch, you name it.
Langdon was amazed. How do they all communicate?
English, of course. The universal language of science.
It took the two men 3 more minutes to reach their destination, a large, well-kept dormitory sitting in a grove of aspens. The carved stone sign in front read, Building C. Following Kohler, Langdon stepped from the elevator on the top floor of Building C. They proceeded down a well-appointed corridor.
Did the man in the fax live up here? Langdon asked. One of your upper-level employees? Quite, Kohler said. He missed a meeting with me this morning and did not answer his page. I came up here to locate him and found him dead in his living room.
Langdon felt a sudden chill, realizing that he was about to see a dead body. Kohler led the way to the far end of the hallway. There was a single door.
The penthouse, as you would say, Kohler announced, dabbing a bead of perspiration from his forehead.
Langdon eyed the lone oak door before them. The nameplate read, Leonardo Vetra.
Leonardo Vetra, Kohler said, would have been 58 next week. He was one of the most brilliant scientists of our time. His death is a profound loss for science.
For an instant, Langdon thought he sensed emotion in Kohler's hardened face, but as quickly as it had come, it was gone. Kohler reached in his pocket and began sifting through a large key ring. An odd thought suddenly occurred to Langdon. The building seemed deserted. Where are the police? Have they left already? Kohler paused, his key halfway into the lock.
Police? The situation is complex, Mr. Langdon.
Langdon felt a wave of apprehension. But certainly someone else knows about this.
Yes. Leonardo's adopted daughter. She is also a physicist here at CERN. She and her father share a lab. They are partners. Ms. Vetra has been away this week doing field research. I have notified her of her father's death, and she is returning as we speak.
Kohler turned the key. As the door swung open, a blast of icy air hissed into the hall and hit Langdon in the face.
Freon cooling system, Kohler said. I chilled the flat to preserve the body.
The corpse on the floor before Langdon was hideous. The late Leonardo Vetra lay on his back, stripped naked, his skin bluish-gray. His face was out of view, pressed against the floor. Fighting a wave of nausea, Langdon let his eyes fall to the victim's chest. The raised, broiled flesh was perfectly delineated, the symbol flawlessly formed. Langdon's heart pounded as he circled the body, reading the word upside down, reaffirming the genius of the symmetry.
Mr. Langdon?
Langdon barely heard. He didn't look up.
How much do you already know?
He asked Toller.
Only that the word Illuminati means the Enlightened Ones, and is the name of some sort of ancient brotherhood.
And you ran a web search for it?
Langdon asked.
Yes. That's how I came to you. As a scientist, I have come to learn that information is only as valuable as its source. Your credentials seemed authentic.
Langdon's eyes were still riveted on the body. Although accounts of the Illuminati emblem were legendary in modern symbology, no academic had ever actually seen it. Ancient documents described the symbol as an ambigram, ambi meaning both, signifying it was legible both ways. And although ambigrams were common in symbology, swastikas, yin-yang, Jewish stars, simple crosses, the idea that a word could be crafted into an ambigram seemed utterly impossible.
So who are the Illuminati?
Kohler demanded.
Yes, Langdon thought. Who indeed?
He began his tale. Since the beginning of history, Langdon explained, a deep rift has existed between science and religion.
Outspoken scientists like Copernicus were murdered, Kohler interjected, murdered by the church for revealing scientific truths. Religion has always persecuted science.
Yes.
But in the 1500s, a group of men in Rome fought back against the church. Some of Italy's most enlightened men, physicists, mathematicians, astronomers, began meeting secretly to share their concerns about the church's inaccurate teachings. They founded the world's first scientific think tank, calling themselves the Enlightened Ones. Of course, the Illuminati were hunted ruthlessly by the Catholic Church. Only through rites of extreme secrecy did the scientists remain safe. Word spread through the academic underground, and the Illuminati Brotherhood grew to include academics from all over Europe. The scientists met regularly in Rome at an ultra-secret lair they called the Church of Illumination. Kohler coughed and shifted in his chair.
Many of the Illuminati, Langdon continued, wanted to combat the church's tyranny with acts of violence, but their most revered member persuaded them against it. He was a pacifist, as well as one of history's most famous scientists. His name was Galileo Galilei.
Kohler looked up.
Galileo?
Yes, Galileo, who was arrested and almost executed by the church for proclaiming that the sun and not the earth was the center of the solar system, was an Illuminatus.
He was also a devout Catholic. He tried to soften the church's position on science by proclaiming that science did not undermine the existence of God, but rather reinforced it. Unfortunately, Langdon added, the unification of science and religion was not what the church wanted.
Of course not, Kohler nodded. The union would have nullified the church's claim as the sole vessel through which man could understand God. I am quite aware of scientific history, Mr. Langdon. But this was all centuries ago. What does it have to do with Leonardo Vetra?
The million-dollar question. Langdon cut to the chase. Galileo's arrest threw the Illuminati into upheaval. Mistakes were made, and the church discovered the identities of four members, whom they captured and interrogated. But the four scientists revealed nothing, even under torture.
Torture?
Langdon nodded. They were branded alive, on the chest, with the symbol of a cross. Kohler's eyes widened, and he shot an uneasy glance at Vetra's body. Then, Langdon continued, the scientists were brutally murdered. Their dead bodies were dropped in the streets of Rome as a warning to others. The Illuminati went deep underground, where they began mixing with other refugee groups fleeing the Catholic purges, mystics, alchemists, occultists, Muslims, Jews. Over the years, a new Illuminati emerged, a darker Illuminati, a deeply anti-Christian Illuminati. Their power grew to the point where the church considered them the single most dangerous anti-Christian force on earth. The Vatican denounced the Brotherhood as Shaitan.
Shaitan.
It's Islamic. It means adversary. God's adversary. The church chose Islam for the name because it was a language they considered dirty. Langdon hesitated. Shaitan is the root of an English word. Satan. An uneasiness crossed Kohler's face. Langdon's voice was grim. Mr. Kohler, I don't know how this marking appeared on this man's chest, or why, but you are looking at the long-lost symbol of the world's oldest and most powerful satanic cult. Kohler looked unsettled.
So this symbol means the Illuminati Brotherhood is resurfacing?
Langdon frowned. That would be impossible. Though the Illuminati were survivors. When they fled Rome, they were taken in by another secret society. A brotherhood of wealthy Bavarian stone craftsmen called the Freemasons. Kohler looked startled.
The Masons? The Masons are not satanic.
Absolutely not, Langdon agreed. But they fell victim to their own benevolence. The Illuminati quietly re-established their scientific brotherhood deep within the Masons, a kind of secret society within a secret society. Then the Illuminati used the worldwide connection of Masonic lodges to spread their influence. Langdon stopped speaking and drew a cold breath.
Mr. Langdon, Kohler said, please sit down.
Langdon sat tentatively on a frost-covered chair. Kohler moved his wheelchair closer.
I am not sure I fully understand everything you have just told me, but I do understand this. Leonardo Vetra was one of CERN's greatest assets. He was also a friend. I need you to help me locate the Illuminati.
Langdon didn't know how to respond.
Locate the Illuminati?
I'm afraid, sir, that would be utterly impossible. There has been no evidence of their existence for over half a century. And even if the Illuminati were still active today, which I am virtually positive they're not, they would never be involved in Leonardo Vetra's death.
No?
No. The Illuminati held men of science in the highest regard. There is no way they would have murdered a fellow scientist like Leonardo Vetra. Kohler's eyes turned to ice.
Perhaps I failed to mention that Leonardo Vetra was anything but an ordinary scientist. Leonardo was a Catholic priest.
Langdon looked startled. A priest? I thought you said he was a physicist.
He was both. Men of science and religion are not unprecedented in history. Leonardo was one of them. He considered physics God's natural law. He was starting to fuse science and religion, showing that they complement each other in most unanticipated ways. He called the field New Physics, and last year he categorically proved the existence of an energy force that unites us all. A sharp beeping sound cut the air, and Langdon looked up. Kohler reached down into the array of electronics on his wheelchair. He slipped a beeper out of its holder and read the incoming message.
Good. That is Leonardo's daughter. Miss Vetra is arriving at the helipad right now. We will meet her there. I think it best she not come up here and see her father this way.
Langdon agreed. It would be a shock no child deserved.
I will ask Miss Vetra to explain the project she and her father have been working on, perhaps shedding light on why he was murdered.
You think Vetra's work is why he was killed? Langdon was surprised.
Quite possibly, Kohler said. Leonardo told me he was working on something groundbreaking. He had become very secretive about the project. He had a private lab and demanded seclusion, which I gladly afforded him on account of his brilliance. His work had been consuming huge amounts of electric power lately, but I refrained from questioning him.
Kohler rotated away from Langdon, then maneuvered to within inches of Vetra's body and stopped.
There is one more thing you need to know before we leave.
Langdon wasn't sure he wanted to hear it.
An item was stolen from Vetra by his murderer.
An item? Reluctantly, Langdon came close, bile rising in his throat.
Look at his face, Kohler said.
Struggling against his handicap, Kohler reached down and carefully twisted Vetra's frozen head. Cracking loudly, the corpse's face rotated into view, contorted in agony. Kohler held it there a moment.
Sweet Jesus!
Langdon cried, stumbling back in horror. Vetra's face was covered in blood. A single hazel eye stared lifelessly back at him. The other socket was tattered and empty.
They stole his eye.
In another country, a young guard sat patiently before an expansive bank of video monitors. He watched as images flashed before him, live feeds from hundreds of wireless video cameras that surveyed the sprawling complex. Suddenly, an image before him registered alarm. With a reflexive jerk that startled even himself, his hand shot out and hit a button on the control panel. The picture before him froze. His nerves tingling, he leaned toward the screen for a closer look. The reading on the monitor told him the image was being transmitted from camera number 86, a camera that was supposed to be overlooking a hallway. But the image before him was most definitely not a hallway. Langdon stepped out of Building C into the open air, grateful to be outside Vetra's flat.
This way, please, Kohler said, veering up a steep path.
Miss Vetra will be arriving any moment. As the two men crossed a grassy rise, the beating of helicopter blades became audible to the west. A chopper appeared, arching across the open valley toward them. It banked sharply, then slowed to a hover over a helipad painted on the grass. As the skids touched down, a pilot jumped out and started unloading gear. There was a lot of it, duffels, vinyl wet bags, scuba tanks, and crates of what appeared to be high-tech diving equipment. Langdon was confused.
Is that Miss Vetra's gear?
He yelled to Kohler over the roar of the engines. Kohler nodded and yelled back,
She was doing biological research in the Balearic Sea.
I thought you said she was a physicist.
She is. She's a bio-entanglement physicist. She studies the interconnectivity of life systems.
Her work ties closely with her father's work in particle physics.
A moment later, Vittorio Vetra emerged from the fuselage. Robert Langdon realized today was going to be a day of endless surprises. Descending from the chopper in her khaki shorts and white sleeveless top, Vittoria Vetra looked nothing like the bookish physicist he had expected. Lithe and graceful, she was tall, with chestnut skin and long black hair that swirled in the back wind of the rotors. Her face was unmistakably Italian, not overly beautiful, but possessing full, earthy features that even at 20 yards seemed to exude a raw sensuality.
"Miss Vetra is a woman of tremendous personal strength," Kohler said, seeming to sense Langdon's captivation. "She is CERN's resident guru of Hatha Yoga."
"Hatha Yoga?" Langdon mused. The ancient Buddhist art of meditative stretching seemed an odd proficiency for the physicist's daughter of a Catholic priest.
"Vittoria," Kohler said as she approached, "my deepest condolences. It's a terrible loss for science, for all of us here at CERN."
Vittoria nodded gratefully. She had obviously been crying. When she spoke, her voice was smooth.
"Do you know who is responsible yet?"
"We're still working on it."
She turned to Langdon, holding out a slender hand.
"My name is Vittoria Vetra. You're from Interpol, I assume."
"Robert Langdon." He was unsure what else to say.
"Mr. Langdon is not with the authorities," Kohler explained. "He is a specialist from the U.S. He's here to help us locate who is responsible for this situation."
Vittoria looked uncertain.
"And the police?"
Kohler exhaled and then said,
"I have told neither the police nor the staff."
"You haven't told anyone my father was murdered?"
Vittoria's mystified tone was now laced with anger. Kohler's tone hardened instantly.
"Perhaps you forget, Miss Vetra. As soon as I report your father's murder, there will be an investigation of CERN. Before we report anything to the authorities, I need to know what you two were working on. I need you to take us to your lab."
Arriving back at the main atrium, Langdon, Kohler, and Vittoria took the elevator to Dr. Vetra's subterranean lab. When the elevator thumped to a stop, they were 6 stories deep in the earth. Vittoria exited the elevator and strode off without hesitation into the darkness without them. Overhead, the fluorescence flickered on to light her path. The effect was unsettling, Langdon thought, as if the tunnel were alive, anticipating her every move. Langdon and Kohler followed, trailing a distance behind. The lights extinguished automatically behind them. At that moment, hundreds of miles from CERN, a voice crackled through a walkie-talkie.
"Okay, I'm in the hallway."
The technician monitoring the video screens pressed the button on his transmitter.
"You're looking for camera number 86. It's supposed to be at the far end."
There was a long silence on the radio. The waiting technician broke a light sweat. Finally, his radio clicked.
"The camera isn't here," the voice said. "I can see where it was mounted, though. Somebody must have removed it."
The technician exhaled heavily.
"Thanks. Hold on a second, will you?"
The technician gazed up at the image the lost camera was transmitting. It was a stationary object, a modern-looking device like nothing he had ever seen. He studied the blinking electronic display at its base. "Today of all days," he thought. Then, sweating, he dialed his superior. Vittoria Vetra's body felt numb as she strode down the tunnel toward her father's lab. Already she sensed his absence. CERN, her world since she was 12, seemed suddenly foreign. Her father, the man who had made it magical, was gone.
Deep breaths, she told herself, but she couldn't calm her mind. She realized she was about to unveil her father's greatest achievement without him there. She had pictured this moment much differently. She had imagined her father calling CERN's top scientists to his lab, showing them his discovery, watching their awestruck faces.
Victoria, Kohler said as they approached the lab's imposing steel door. I should mention that I came down here this morning looking for your father.
Victoria flushed slightly.
You did?
Yes. And imagine my surprise when I discovered he had replaced CERN's standard keypad security with something else.
Kohler motioned to an intricate electronic device mounted beside the door.
I apologize, she said. You know how he was about privacy. He didn't want anyone but the two of us to have access.
Kohler said,
Fine. Open the door.
Victoria stood a long moment. Then, pulling a deep breath, she walked to the mechanism on the wall. Langdon was in no way prepared for what happened next. Victoria stepped up to the device and carefully aligned her right eye with a protruding lens that looked like a telescope. Then she pressed a button. Inside the machine, something clicked. A shaft of light oscillated back and forth, scanning her eyeball like a copy machine.
It's a retina scan, she said. Infallible security. Authorized for two retina patterns only, mine and my father's.
Robert Langdon stood in horrified revelation. The image of Leonardo Vetra came back in grisly detail. The bloody face, the solitary hazel eyes staring back, and the empty eye socket. He tried to reject the obvious truth, but then he saw it, beneath the scanner on the white tile floor, faint droplets of crimson, dried blood. Victoria, thankfully, didn't notice. The steel door slid open and she walked through. Kohler looked uneasy as he and Langdon entered behind her. His eyes seemed to dart about for signs of an intruder. But the stark white lab was deserted. Kohler turned to Victoria.
Has anything been stolen?
Stolen? How? She argued. The retina scan only allows entry to us.
Just look around, Kohler insisted.
Victoria sighed and surveyed the room for a few moments.
She shrugged. Everything looks as my father always leaves it. Ordered chaos.
All right. Now please talk to us, Victoria, Kohler said. Tell us what the two of you were up to.
Where to begin, she said.
At the beginning, Kohler said. Tell us about your father's experiment.
Rectifying science with religion has been my father's life dream, Victoria said. He hoped to prove that science and religion are two totally compatible fields, two different approaches to finding the same truth. And recently, he conceived of a way to do that.
Kohler remained silent.
Mr. Langdon, Victoria said, turning. I assume you are familiar with the Big Bang theory.
Langdon shrugged. Of course, more or less. Victoria continued.
Although proposed by a Catholic monk, Georges Lemaître, in 1927, scientists immediately mathematized the Big Bang theory, removed all religious overtones, and claimed it as their own. Unfortunately for science, however, their equations, even today, have one serious deficiency that the church likes to point out.
Kohler grunted.
The singularity.
He spoke the word as if it were the bane of his existence.
Yes, the singularity, Victoria said. The exact moment of creation. Time zero.
She looked at Langdon.
Even today, science cannot grasp the initial moment of creation. But my father believed someday it would.
She ran a hand through her long hair, looking melancholy.
He set out to do something no scientist had ever thought to do. Something that no one has ever had the technology to do. She paused as though uncertain how to speak the next words. He designed an experiment to prove Genesis was possible.
Kohler's dead gaze bored across the room.
I beg your pardon.
My father created a universe from nothing at all. It was done on a much smaller scale, of course. Vittoria went on, talking faster now. The process was remarkably simple. He accelerated two ultra-thin particle beams in opposite directions. The two beams collided head-on at enormous speeds, driving into one another and compressing all their energy into a single pinpoint. Without warning, inside the accelerator tube, particles of matter began appearing out of nowhere.
Kohler made no reaction. He simply stared.
Matter, Vittoria repeated, blossoming out of nothing. An incredible display of subatomic fireworks. He proved not only that matter can be created from nothing, but that the Big Bang and Genesis can be explained simply by accepting the presence of an enormous source of energy.
You mean God?
Kohler demanded.
She nodded briskly. God, Buddha, the Force, Yahweh, the singularity, the unicity point, call it whatever you like. The result is the same. Science and religion support the same truth. Pure energy is the father of creation.
When Kohler finally spoke, his voice was somber.
Vittoria, you have me at a loss. It sounds like you're telling me your father created matter out of nothing.
Yes.
Vittoria motioned to some canisters standing on pillars near the center of the room.
And there is the proof. In those canisters are specimens of the matter he created.
Kohler coughed and moved toward the canisters like a wary animal, circling something he instinctively sensed was wrong.
How do you expect anyone to believe these canisters contain particles of matter your father actually created? They could be particles from anywhere at all.
Actually, Vittoria said, sounding confident, they couldn't. These particles are unique.
They are a type of matter that does not exist anywhere on Earth. Hence, they had to be created.
Kohler's face hardened. Vittoria, surely you can't be saying those canisters contain actual specimens.
I am.
She gazed proudly at the canisters.
Director, you are looking at the world's first specimens of antimatter.
Phase two, the assassin thought, striding into the darkened tunnel with his torch. There was no mirror in the passage to admire his disguise, but he could sense from the shadow of his billowing robe that he was perfect. 2 weeks ago, he would have considered the task awaiting him at the far end of this tunnel impossible, a suicide mission, walking naked into a lion's lair. But Janus had changed the definition of impossible. As he drew closer to his enemy, the assassin wondered if what awaited him inside would be as easy as Janus had promised. Janus had assured him someone on the inside would make the necessary arrangements. Someone on the inside. Incredible. The more he considered it, the more he realized it was child's play.
I suppose you've heard of antimatter, Mr. Langdon.
Vittoria was studying him, her dark skin in stark contrast to the white lab. Langdon felt suddenly dumb.
Yes, well, sort of. Isn't antimatter what fuels the USS Enterprise?
She nodded.
Good science fiction has its roots in good science. Scientists have known since 1918 that two kinds of matter were created in the Big Bang. One matter is the kind we see here on Earth, making up rocks, trees, people. The other is its inverse, identical to matter in all respects, except that the charges of its particles are reversed.
Kohler spoke as though emerging from a fog. His voice sounded suddenly precarious.
But even if what you say is true, these canisters are certainly made of matter. Antimatter cannot be stored inside canisters made out of matter. The antimatter would instantly react with...
The specimen is not touching the canister, Vittoria said, apparently expecting the question. The antimatter is suspended.
The canisters are called antimatter traps, because they literally trap the antimatter in the center of the canister, suspending it at a safe distance from the sides and bottom.
Suspended? But how?
Between two intersecting magnetic fields. It was my own design. My father produced the first particles of antimatter, but was stymied by how to store them. I suggested these. Airtight nanocomposite shells with opposing electromagnets at each end.
Where's the power source for the magnets? Kohler asked.
Vittoria pointed. In the pillar beneath the trap. The canisters are screwed into a docking port that continuously recharges them so the magnets never fail.
And if the field fails?
The obvious. The antimatter falls out of suspension, hits the bottom of the trap, and we see an annihilation.
Langdon's ears pricked up.
Annihilation? He didn't like the sound of it. Vittoria looked unconcerned. Yes. If antimatter and matter make contact, both are destroyed instantly. Physicists call the process annihilation. I'm afraid antimatter has some astonishing characteristics, Mr. Langdon, which make it quite dangerous. A 10-milligram sample, the volume of a grain of sand, is hypothesized to hold as much energy as about 200 metric tons of conventional rocket fuel. It is the energy source of tomorrow, 1,000 times more powerful than nuclear energy. 100% efficient, no byproducts, no radiation, no pollution. A few grams could power a major city for a week.
Vittoria turned to Kohler.
And now, I want to see my father, she demanded. I showed you the lab. Now I want to see my father.
Kohler stared at her.
Who else knew about this?
He asked.
No one, Vittoria said. I told you that.
Kohler exhaled. He paused as though choosing his next words carefully.
Suppose someone did find out. And suppose someone gained access to this lab. What do you imagine they would be after? What would be missing?
I have no idea. Vittoria angrily scanned the lab. Everything up here looks fine.
Kohler looked surprised.
Up here?
Vittoria had said it instinctively.
Yes, here in the upper lab.
You're using the lower lab, too?
For storage.
Kohler rolled toward her, coughing again.
You're using the hazmat chamber for storage. Storage of what?
Vittoria was losing her patience.
Antimatter.
Kohler lifted himself on the arms of his chair.
There are other specimens? Why the hell didn't you tell me?
I just did, Vittoria fired back. And you've barely given me a chance.
We need to check those specimens, Kohler said. Now.
Specimen, Vittoria corrected. Singular. And it's fine. Nobody could ever...
Only one?
Kohler hesitated.
Why isn't it up here?
My father wanted it below the bedrock as a precaution. It's larger than the others.
Although Vittoria's father had been hesitant to create a large specimen, Vittoria had pushed him hard. She argued that in order for antimatter to be taken seriously, she and her father had to prove two things. First, that cost-effective amounts could be produced. And second, that the specimens could be safely stored. In the end, she had won, and her father had acquiesced against his better judgment.
Vittoria,
Kohler insisted, his voice tense. How large a specimen did you and your father create? Vittoria felt a wry pleasure inside. She knew the amount would stun even the great Maximilian Kohler. She took a deep breath. A full quarter of a gram. The blood drained from Kohler's face.
What? That converts to almost 5 kilotons. That much antimatter could literally liquidate everything in a half-mile radius.
Kohler was already heading for the elevator.
Which is why, Vittoria said, my father kept it in hazmat, under a fail-safe power and a redundant security system.
Kohler turned, looking hopeful.
You have additional security on hazmat?
Yes, a second retina scan.
Kohler spoke only 2 words.
Downstairs. Now.
The freight elevator dropped like a rock, another 75 feet into the earth. When they reached the bottom, the elevator opened, and Vittoria led the way down the dimly lit corridor. Up ahead, the corridor dead-ended at a huge steel door. Hazmat. The retina scan device beside the door was identical to the one upstairs. She approached. Carefully, she aligned her eye with the lens. She pulled back. Something was wrong. The usually spotless lens was spattered, smeared with something that looked like blood. Confused, she turned to the 2 men, but her gaze met waxen faces. Both Kohler and Langdon were white, their eyes fixed on the floor at her feet. Vittoria followed their line of sight, down.
No!
Langdon yelled, reaching for her. But it was too late. Vittoria's vision locked on the object on the floor. It was both utterly foreign and intimately familiar to her. Her father's hazel eyeball. The security technician held his breath as his commander leaned over his shoulder, studying the bank of security monitors before them. The object they were pondering on the monitor was a canister of some sort. A canister with transparent sides. That much was easy. It was the rest that was difficult. Inside the container, as if by some special effect, a small droplet of metallic liquid seemed to be floating in midair. The droplet appeared and disappeared in the robotic red blinking of a digital LED descending resolutely, making the technician's skin crawl.
Can you lighten the contrast?
The commander asked, startling the technician. The technician heeded the instruction and, ever so faintly, printed next to the LED, 4 capital letters came into view. Fifty meters below ground, Vittoria Vetra stumbled forward, almost falling into the retina scan. The mechanism beeped and the door slid open. Even with the terror of her father's eye boring into her soul, Vittoria sensed an additional horror awaited inside. When she leveled her blurry gaze into the room, she confirmed the next chapter of the nightmare. Before her, the solitary, recharging podium was empty. The canister was gone. They had cut out her father's eye to steal it. Once removed from its recharging platform at CERN, the canister would count down inexorably. A runaway train. And when time ran out, the countdown had begun. Langdon didn't know what else to do. He took his handkerchief and laid it on the floor over Leonardo Vetra's eyeball.
Mr. Langdon.
Kohler's face was expressionless. He motioned Langdon out of earshot. Langdon reluctantly followed, leaving Vittoria to fend for herself.
You're the specialist, Kohler said, his whisper intense. I want to know what these Illuminati bastards intend to do with this antimatter.
Langdon tried to focus. The Illuminati had always wielded tremendous power through financial means. They controlled banks. They owned gold bullion. They were even rumored to possess the single most valuable gem on Earth, the Illuminati diamond, a flawless diamond of enormous proportions. Money, Langdon said. The antimatter could have been stolen for financial gain. Kohler looked incredulous.
Financial gain? Where does one sell a droplet of antimatter?
Not the specimen, Langdon countered. The technology. Kohler shook his head.
That canister has only 24 hours before the batteries die. Researchers would blow themselves up before they learned anything at all.
He's right.
Vittoria's voice was frail. Both men turned. Vittoria was moving toward them, her gait as tremulous as her words.
We need to call Interpol, she added.
Even to herself, her voice sounded distant.
We need to call the proper authorities immediately.
Kohler shook his head.
Absolutely not.
The assassin stood at the end of the stone tunnel. It was almost time. Janus had promised someone on the inside would open the door. Minutes later, exactly at the appointed hour, there was a loud clank of heavy keys on the other side of the door. Metal scraped on metal as multiple locks disengaged. One by one, three huge deadbolts ground open. Vittoria headed for the door.
Please stop!
The director sounded asthmatic now, as he accelerated after her.
Just tell me what you want. We need to work together here.
Vittoria came to a full stop halfway across the lab, but she did not turn.
I want to find the antimatter, and I want to know who killed my father.
She waited. Kohler sighed.
Vittoria, we already know who killed your father.
Now Vittoria turned.
You what?
I didn't know how to tell you. It's difficult.
You know who killed my father?
We have a very good idea, yes. The killer left somewhat of a calling card. That's the reason I called Mr. Langdon. The group claiming responsibility is his specialty.
She turned to him. Mr. Langdon, I want to know who killed my father. And I want to know if your agency can find the antimatter.
Langdon looked flustered.
My agency? You're with U.S. intelligence, I assume?
Actually, no.
Kohler intervened.
Mr. Langdon is a professor of art history at Harvard University.
Vittoria felt like she had been doused with ice water.
An art teacher?
He is a specialist in cult symbology, Kohler sighed. Vittoria, we believe your father was killed by a satanic cult. The group claiming responsibility calls themselves the Illuminati. Please, let me explain.
Kohler's secretary, Sylvie Baudeloc, had begun to get concerned when Kohler failed to return at the proper time for his daily injections. At the moment, however, her concern for the director's health was taking a back burner, replaced by a much more pressing dilemma. The CERN switchboard had phoned 5 minutes ago in a frenzy to say they had an urgent call for the director.
He's not available,
Sylvie had said. Then the CERN operator told her who was calling. Sylvie half laughed aloud.
You're kidding, right?
She listened, and her face clouded with disbelief.
And your caller ID confirms.
Sylvie was frowning.
I see. Okay. So what do I do? She now wondered.
Short of searching CERN's entire complex herself, Sylvie knew there was only one other way to get the director's attention. Startled with her own boldness,
She walked into Kohler's office and went to the metal box on the wall behind his desk. She opened the cover, stared at the controls, and found the correct button. Then she took a deep breath and grabbed the microphone. Vittoria didn't remember how they had gotten to the main elevator, but they were there. She looked to Langdon. The earnest concern in his gaze felt like the warmth of a guardian angel, especially in the aura of Kohler's chill.
"Maximilian Kohler, kindly call your office immediately."
Blazing sunbeams flooded Langdon's eyes as the elevator doors opened into the main atrium.
"Director Kohler, please call your office."
The sound of his name on the PA seemed to startle Kohler. He glanced up, looking angered, and then almost immediately concerned. Langdon's eyes met his and Vittoria's, too. Kohler took his cell phone from the armrest. He dialed an extension and fought off another coughing fit. Vittoria and Langdon waited.
"This is Director Kohler," he said, wheezing. "Yes, I was subterranean, out of range."
He listened, his gray eyes widening.
"Who? Yes, patch it through."
There was a pause.
"Hello, this is Maximilian Kohler. I am the director of CERN. With whom am I speaking?"
Vittoria and Langdon watched in silence as Kohler listened.
"It would be unwise," Kohler finally said, "to speak of this by phone. I will be there immediately."
He was coughing again.
"Meet me at Leonardo da Vinci Airport. 40 minutes.
Kohler's breath seemed to be failing him now. He descended into a fit of coughing and barely managed to choke out the words.
"Locate the canister immediately. I am coming."
Then he clicked off his phone. Vittoria ran to Kohler's side, but Kohler could no longer speak. Langdon watched as Vittoria pulled out her cell phone and paged CERN's infirmary. A few seconds later, two paramedics materialized, racing across the atrium in white smocks. They knelt by Kohler, putting an oxygen mask on his face. Scientists in the hall stopped and stood back. Kohler took two long pulls, pushed the mask aside, and still gasping for air, looked up at Vittoria and Langdon.
"Rome."
"Rome?" Vittoria demanded. "The antimatter is in Rome? Who called?" Kohler's face was twisted, his gray eyes watering.
"The Swiss."
He choked on the words, and the paramedics put the mask back over his face. As they prepared to take him away, Kohler reached up and grabbed Langdon's arm. Langdon nodded. He knew.
"Go!"
Kohler wheezed beneath his mask.
"Go! Call me!"
Then the paramedics were rolling him away. Vittoria stood riveted to the floor, watching him go. Then she turned to Langdon.
"Rome? But what was that about the Swiss?"
Langdon put a hand on her shoulder, barely whispering the words.
"The Swiss Guard," he said. "The sworn sentinels of Vatican City."
The X-33 space plane roared into the sky and arced south toward Rome. On board, Langdon sat in silence. Now that he had finished briefing Vittoria on the Illuminati and their covenant against the Vatican, the scope of the situation was starting to sink in.
"Thanks for coming,"
Vittoria said, her voice quiet. Langdon emerged from his thoughts and looked up. Vittoria was sitting across the aisle. Even in the stark fluorescent light of the cabin, there was an aura of composure about her, an almost magnetic radiance of wholeness. She had not had time to change from her shorts and sleeveless top, and her tawny legs were now goosebumped in the cold of the plane. Instinctively, Langdon removed his jacket and offered it to her.
"American chivalry?"
She accepted, her eyes thanking him silently.
Looking at her, Langdon felt something stir within him that he had not felt in a long time. There was a bewitching clarity in her eyes, a purity in her voice. He felt drawn.